to the Silly Anti-Sissy Show, where we guide you and give you love, where we give you everything you need. We sing songs and I'll give you candy, 'cause I'm your favorite auntie. Thanks for listening, guys, and let's get to it! Yay! Turtle says yay. He's dancing with me. Yay, Turtle! And Dino says yay! Welcome to the Silly Auntie Sissy Show. I love you, Silly Auntie Sissy. I love you, Dino. And I love you, Turtle. We all love Silly Auntie Sissy. She's our favorite auntie. So we have a great night plan today. Yes, we do. We're going to sing some songs from Let's Play Together, Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. And we're going to read Secret Garden, Chapter 4. And what else will we do? We're going to talk, Dino, about Labor Day. What's Labor Day? Well, Labor Day is a very fun day that we honor all the workers who do very nice things for us. Oh, well, that's great. Thank you, workers. You're welcome, they say. Dino thanks you, and I thank you. And that was Monday. And it's the Jewish New Year. And the Jewish New Year is a very important day. The Jewish New Year? That's right, Dino. The Jewish New Year is a big, important day for everybody. The Jewish New Year makes everybody happy. It's a day where Jewish people... Do we know what Jewish people are? What are Jewish people, Auntie Sissy? Silly Auntie Sissy? Well, Jewish people are people that are just like everybody else, except they celebrate a different God, and they come from the Israel in the Middle East. Yeah, they come from the Middle East. So, but they come from all over the world. Some live in America, and some live in Israel, and some live in Poland, and France, and Italy, in Germany, and where else? Russia? Anywhere. Mexico, Spain, even China in the Orient. There's a lot of different types of Jewish people. But the one thing, Dino, they all have in common is that on the Jewish New Year, we all listen to the chauffeur. And that crazy sound was the chauffeur. And you do that, and that means you're going to have a blessed New Year. So everybody who listens is going to have a Jewish New Year. Can I try it, Silly Auntie Sissy? Sure, Dino. Very good, Dino. Yay, Dino. And you can try it too. You can get a chauffeur if you want to try it. It's a very beautiful thing and it's very, very ancient. It comes from, well, it's a very tribal thing. Jewish are very tribal, you know. All Jews come from Jesus. Well, not all Jews. But when Jewish people were around, that was the very first religion. And then Christianity came about when Jesus died and they separated. So that they were the very first Jews for Jesus. Oh, that's right. Indeed. So the Jews and Jesus separated and they became two different religions. And when was that? Yesterday? Oh, Dino. That was thousands of years ago. The Jewish people, we are in, shall I tell you what year we're in? Yes, please, Silly Auntie Sissy. Well, the Jewish people are in a different year. In the regular new year, we'll go into 2022. But the Jews, us Jews, are now in 5782. That means that was because they don't believe in the Jesus part. Jews don't believe in the Jesus part. So we're a very long time away. We're very far away. So we never catch up. But so there you go. That happened thousands, if not millions of years ago when Jesus lived and we separated. But that's okay. Yeah, it is okay, isn't it? It is. Well, and that was our history lesson. So happy New Year, and everyone heard the show first. So yay! And now we're going to have some fun. Yay for fun! Turtle says yay for fun too. Yay for fun. Turtle says yay for fun. Let's dance. Dino and Turtle and Silly Auntie Sissy. Dancing, dancing, prancing and wancing. Yay. And later on, we're going to have a very special guest called Victoria Fain. She is a great person and a very good director. And we're going to talk about her. And we're going to talk with her too. And she lives in London. Where's London, Silly Auntie Sissy? Well, London is very far away. You get on a plane and you just go and go far away. It takes a lot of hours to get there. So, there you go. And she made a movie. Wow. She's made a few. Wow, I know. Isn't that amazing and fun? It is. So, everyone will see it. It'll come out in a few months and it'll go places. So yay, we'll talk about that, Dino. And let's read, shall we read? And then we'll get into the let's play together. Let's do that first, Dino. What do you say? How about pretend cement? Well, if you guys have kids, yes, please. Oh, wait. Blowing bubbles and pretend cement. Well, here's a good one. You'll need sand and water or salt, flour, and water containers. So then, if the weather's nice, give your child a container with sand and water inside and let them mix it to make cement. They can pour in the yard or pretend to fill cracks in a driveway or porch. If playing indoors, mix 1 cup of salt with 2 cups of flour and add 1/2 cup of cold water. Mix with your hands for homemade modeling clay. Roll it out and let your child make a print with their hands, fingers, or feet. After several hours, the clay will harden like real cement. Oh, that is cool. And blowing bubbles. You'll need straws, bowls, dish soap, bubble wands, optional. Add soap to 1/2 full bowl of water and show your child how to make the bubbles. Make sure they practice blowing out of a straw before letting them do so in the bowl. And two, if you can go outside afterward and use a bubble wand to make bubbles that float in the air. So yay, there you go, you can make your own bubbles. And the last one is boxes inside of boxes. These are fun autumn ideas. What's autumn? Autumn is when autumn, Dino and Turtle and everyone else, autumn is when all the leaves fall and everyone gets ready for winter. And winter is when the snow falls. So boxes inside of boxes. You'll need 5 to 6 boxes of graduated sizes, so each box fits into the box of the next size. Larger ring box, popcorn box, shirt, etc. Small toys that will fit into the smallest box. Without your child knowing, place the toy inside the smallest box, then place each box inside the other. Give the boxes to your child to open. If doing this with more than one child, have them take turns opening the boxes. After the smallest box is opened, come up with ideas of what to do with the boxes. You can ask them, do you want to put the boxes together? Do you want to build something with the boxes? And pretend cement, what does the cement feel like? What happens when it dries? And with the bubbles, what is inside the bubbles? What happens when you touch them? If you don't have a bubble, by the way, bubble wand, you can use a wire hanger to make very large bubbles. Wow. Well, that sounds like fun. Well, I hope you guys have got some great ideas on how to make bubbles. Now, Dino and Turtle, we're going to read The Secret Garden, Chapter 4. Are you guys ready? Yay! Yes, yesy. All right, get ready. Here we go. The Secret Garden, Chapter 4. And do you remember where we left off, you guys? Well, I'll tell you. She just arrived at Mithilthwaite Manor, and they gave her room and told her she couldn't leave the room. And then the next day, she met Martha. When she opened her eyes in the morning, it was because a young housemaid had come into her room to light the fire and was kneeling on the hearth rug, raking out the cinders, noisily. Mary lay and watched her for a few moments and then began to look about the room. She had never seen a room at all like it and thought it curious and gloomy. The walls were covered with tapestry, with a forest scene embroidered on it. There were fantastically dressed people under the trees, and in a distance there was a glimpse of the turrets of a castle. There were hunters and horses and dogs and ladies. Mary felt as if she were in the forest with them. Out of a deep window she could see a climbing stretch of land which seemed to have no trees on it, and to look rather like an endless, dull, purplish sea. "What is that?" she said, pointing out the window. Martha, the young housemaid, who had just risen to her feet, looked and pointed also. "That there?" she said. "That there?" she said. "Yes." "That's thy moor," with a good-natured grin. "Does I like it?" "No," answered Mary, "I hate it." "That's because thou art used to it," Martha said, going back to her hearth. "Thou thinks it's too big and bare now, but thou will like it." "Do you?" inquired Mary. "Aye, that I do," answered Martha, cheerfully polishing away at the grate. "I just love it. It's none bare. It's covered with growing things as small smells sweet. It's fair lovely in spring and summer when the gorse and broom and heather's in flower. It smells so honey, and there's such a lot of fresh air. And that sky looks so high, and the bees and skylarks make such a nice noise humming and singing. Eh, I wouldn't live away from the moor for anything." Mary listened to her with a grave, puzzled expression. The native servants she had used in India were not in the least like this. They were obsequious and servile, and did not presume to talk to their masters as if they were equals. They made salams and called them protector of the poor, and names of that sort. Indian servants were commanded to do things, not asked. It was not the custom to say please and thank you, and Mary had always slapped her eye in the face when she was angry. She wondered a little what this girl would do if one slapped her in the face. She was a round, rosy, good-natured-looking creature, but she had a sturdy way which made Mistress Mary wonder if she might not even slap back if the person who slapped her was only a little girl. "You are a strange servant," she said from her pillows, rather hauntingly. Martha sat up in her heels with her blackened brush in her hand and laughed without seeming the least out of temper. "Eh, I know that. If there was a grand missus at Mithilthwaite, I should never have been out of the under housemaids. I might have been let to be scullery maid, but I'd never have been let upstairs. I'm too common and talk too much, Yorkshire. But this is a funny house for all is so grand. Seems like there's neither master nor mistress, except Mr. Pitcher and Mrs. Medlock. Mr. Craven, he won't be troubled about anything when he's here, and he's nearly always away anyway. Mrs. Medlock gave me the place out of kindness. She told me she could never have done it if Mistlethwaite had been like other big houses. Are you going to be my servant? Mary asked, still in her impetuous little Indian way. Martha began to rub again. I'm Mrs. Medlock's servant, she said stoutly, and she's Mr. Craven's, but I'm to do the housemaid's work up here and wait on you a bit, but you won't need much waiting on. Who's going to dress me? Demanded Mary. Martha sat up on her heels again and stared. She spoke in broad Yorkshire in her amazement. Can thou not dress thyself? She said. What do you mean? I don't understand your language, answered Mary. Eh, I forgot. Mrs. Medlock told me I'd have to be careful. You wouldn't know what I was saying. I mean, can't you put on your own clothes? No, answered Mary, quite indignantly. I never did in my life. My eye had dressed me, of course. Well, said Martha, evidently not in the least aware that she was impudent. It's time that thou learn. Thou cannot begin younger. I'll do thee good to wait on thou in a bit. My mother always said she couldn't see why grand people's children didn't turn out fair fools, what with nurses and being washed and dressed and took out to walk as if they were puppies. It's different in India, said Mistress Mary disdainfully. She could scarcely stand this, but Martha was not at all crushed. Eh, I can see it's different, she answered almost sympathetically. I dare say it's because there's such a lot of blacks there instead of respectable white people. When I heard you was coming from India, I thought you was a black, too. Mary sat up in bed, ferocious. What? She said. What? You thought I was a native? You daughter of a pig! Martha stared and looked hot. What are you calling names? You needn't be so vexed. It's not that waiting for a young lady to talk. I've nothing against the blacks. When you read about them in tracts, they're always very religious. You always read as a black man and a brother. I've never seen a black, and I was fair pleased to think I was going to see one close. When I come in to light your fire this morning, I crept up to your bed and pulled the cover back to look at you. And I was surprised that you was... Well, I was disappointed, Lee. No more black than me, for all you're so yeller. Mary did not even try to control her rage and humiliation. You thought I was a native? You dared? You don't know anything about natives. They're not people. They're servants who must belong to you. You know nothing about India. You know nothing about anything. She was in such a rage and felt so helpless before the girl's simple stare. And somehow, she suddenly felt so horribly lonely and far away from anything she understood and which understand her, that she threw herself face downward on the pillows and burst into a passionate sobbing. She sobbed so unrestrainably that good-natured Yorkshire Martha was a little frightened and quite sorry for her. She went to bed and bent over her. "Eh, you mustn't cry like that there," she begged. "You mustn't for sure. I don't know you'd be vexed. I didn't know anything about anything, just like you said. I beg your pardon, miss. Do stop crying." "Crying?" There was something comforting and really friendly in her queer Yorkshire speech and sturdy way, which had a good effect on Mary. She gradually ceased crying and became quiet. Martha looked relieved. "It's time for thee to get up," she said. "Mrs. Medlock said I was carrying the breakfast and tea and dinner into the room next to this. It's been made into a nursery for thee. I'll help thee on with the clothes if thou get out of bed. If thou buttons aren't at that back, then thou cannot button them up thyself." When Mary at last decided to get up, the clothes Martha took from the wardrobe were not the ones she had worn when she arrived the night before with Mrs. Medlock. "These aren't mine," she said. "Mine are black." She looked the thick white wool coat and dress over and added with a cool approval, "Those are nicer than mine." "These are nicer than mine." "These are the ones that thou must put on," Martha answered. "Mr. Craven ordered Mr. Medlock to get him in London. He said I won't have a child dressed in black wandering about like a lost soul. He said it'd make the place sadder than it is. Put color on her. Mother said she knew what he meant. Mother always knows what a body means. She doesn't hold with the black herself." "I hate black things," said Mary. The dressing process was one which taught them both something. Martha had buttoned up her little sisters and brothers, but she had never seen a child who stood still and waited for another person to do things for her, as she had neither hands nor feet of her own. "Why doesn't thou put on their own shoes?" she said, when Mary quietly held out her feet. "My eye did it," answered Mary, staring. It was the custom. She said that very often. It was the custom. The native servants were always saying it. If one told them to do a thing their ancestors had not done for 1,000 years, they gazed at one mildly and said, "It's not the custom." And one knew that that was the end of the matter. It had been the custom. It had not been the custom that Mrs. Mary should do anything but stand and allow herself to be dressed like a doll. Before she was ready for breakfast, she began to suspect that her life at Misselswipe Manor would end by teaching her a number of things quite new to her. Things such as putting on her own shoes and stockings, and picking up things she let fall. If Martha had been a well-trained, fine young lady's maid, she would have been more subservient and respectful, and would have known that it was her business to brush hair and button boots and pick things up and lay them away. She was ever only an untrained Yorkshire rustic, who had been brought up in a moorland cottage with a swarm of little brothers and sisters, who had never dreamed of doing anything but waiting on themselves and the younger ones, who were neither either babies in arms or just learning to totter about and tumble over things. If Mary Lennox had been a child who was ready to be amused, she would perhaps have laughed at Martha's readiness to talk. But Mary only listened to her coldly and wondered at the freedom of manner. At first she was not at all interested, but gradually, as the girl routed on in her good-natured, homely way, Mary began to notice what was she saying. "Eh, you should see 'em all," she said. "There's 12 of us, and my father only gets 16 shillings a week. I can tell you my mother put up to get porridge from all. They tumble about on the moor and play there all day, and mother says the air of the moor fattens them. She says she believes they eat the grass same as the old ponies do. Our Dickon, he's 12 years old, and he's got a young pony he calls his own." "Where did he get it?" asked Mary. "He found it on the moor with his mother when it was a little one, and he began to make friends with it and give it to bits of bread and pluck your grass for it, and it got to like him so it follows him about and lets him get on back. Dickon's a kind lad, and animals like him." Mary had never possessed an animal pet of her own, and always thought she should like one. So she began to feel a slight interest in Dickon, and as she had never before been interested in anything but herself, it was the darling of a healthy settlement. When she went into a room, which had been made into a nursery for her, she found that it was rather like the one she had slept in. It was not a child's room, but a grown-up person's room, with gloomy old pictures on the walls and heavily old oak chairs. A table in the center was set with good substantial breakfast, but she had always been a very small appetite, and she looked with something more than indifference at the very first plate Martha set before her. "I don't want it," she said. "That thou doesn't want thy porridge?" Martha exclaimed incredulously. "No, thou doesn't know how good it is. Put a bit of treacle on, or a bit of sugar." "I don't want it," repeated Mary. "Eh," said Martha, "I can't abide to see good vertuals go to waste. If our children was at the table, they'd clean it bare in 5 minutes." "Why?" said Mary coldly. "Why?" echoed Martha. "Because they scarce ever had their stomachs full in their lives. They're as hungry as young hawks and foxes." "I don't know what it is to be hungry," said Mary with the indulgence of ignorances. Martha looked indignant. "Well, it would be good to try it. I can see that plain enough," she said outspoken. "I've no patience with folks and sits and stares at good bread and meat. My word, don't I wish Dickon and Phil and Jane and the rest of them had what's here under their pinafores?" "Why don't you take it to them?" suggested Mary. "It's not mine," said Martha stoutly, "and this isn't my day out. I get my day out once a month, same as the rest. Then I go home and clean up for my mother and give her a day's rest." Martha drank some tea and ate a little toast and some marmalade. "You wrap 'em up warm and run out and play," said Martha. "I'll do you some good. It'll do you some good and give you some stomach for your meat." Martha went to the window. There were gardens and paths, and Mary went to the window. There were gardens and paths and big trees, but everything looked dull and wintry. "Out? Why should I go out on a day like this?" "Well, if thou doesn't go out, thou'll have to stay in, and what has thou got to do?" Mary glanced about her. There was nothing to do. When Mrs. Medlock had prepared the nursery, she had not thought of amusement. Perhaps it would be better to go and see what the gardens were like. "Who will go with me?" she inquired. Martha stared. "You'll go out by yourself," she answered. "You'll have to learn to play like the other children does when they have gotten up brothers and sisters. Our Dickon goes off by the moor by himself and plays for hours. That's how he made friends with the pony. He got sheep on the moor and that knows him and burrs and it comes out and eats out of his hand. However little there is to eat, he always saves a bit of his bread to coax his pets." It was really this mention of Dickon which made Mary decide to go out, though she was not aware of it. There would be birds outside, though. There would not be ponies. Or sheep. There would be different from the birds in India, and it might amuse her to look at them. Martha found her coat and hat for her and a bit of stout little boots, and she showed her way downstairs. "If thou goes around that way, thou'll come to thy garden," she said, pointing to a gate and a wall of shrubbery. "There's lots of flowers in summertime, but there's nothing blooming now." She seemed to hasten a second before she added, "One of the gardens is locked up. No one has been in it for 10 years. "Why?" asked Mary in spite of herself. Here was another locked door added to the 100 in the strange house. Mr. Craven had it shut when his wife died, so sudden. He wouldn't let no one go inside. It was her garden. He locked the door and dug a hole and buried the key. "There's Mrs. Medlock's bell ringing. I must run." Ding dong, ding dong. "Coming!" After she was gone, Mary turned down the walk, which led to the door in the shrubbery. She could not help thinking about the garden, which no one had been into for 10 years. She wondered what it would look like, and whether there were any flowers still alive in it. When she had passed through the shrubbery gate, she found herself in a great garden, with wide lawns and winding walks with clipped borders. There were trees and flower beds and evergreens clipped into strange shapes, and a large pool with an old gray fountain in it. But the flower beds were bare and wintry, and the fountain was not playing. This is not the garden which is shut up. How could a garden be shut up? You could always walk into a garden. She was just thinking this when she saw at the end of the path she was following there seemed to be a long wall with ivy growing over it. She was not familiar enough with England to know that she was coming upon the kitchen gardens where the vegetables and fruit were growing. She went toward the wall and found that there was a green door in the ivy and that it stood open. This was not the closed garden, evidently, and she could go into it. She went through the door and found that it was a garden with walls all around it, and that it was the only one of several walled gardens which seemed to open into one another. She saw another open door, a green door, revealing bushes and pathways between beds, between winter vegetables. Fruit trees were trained flat against the wall, and over some of the beds there was flat glass frames. The place was bare and ugly enough. Mary thought as she stood and stared about her, it must be nice in the summer when things were green. But there's nothing pretty about it now. Presently, an old man with a spade over his shoulder walked through the door, leaning from the second garden. He looked startled when he saw Mary, and then touched his cap. He had a surly old face and did not seem at all pleased to see her, but then she was displeased with his garden, and wore a quite contrary expression, and certainly did not seem at all pleased to see him. "What is this place?" she asked. "One in that garden kitchens," he answered. "What is that?" said Mary, pointing through the other green door. "Another room, shortly. There's another and another side of the wall there, that orchard other side of that. Can I go in? If thou likes, but there's nothing to see." Mary made no response. She went down the path and through the second green door. Sorry, guys. Intermission. Well, there she found more walls and winter vegetables and glass frames. Perhaps it led into a garden which no one had seen for 10 years. As she was not at all a timid child and always did what she wanted to do, Mary went to the green door and turned the knob. did not handle. She hoped the door would not open because she wanted to be sure she had found the mysterious garden, but it did open, and quite easily at that. There were walls all around it also, and trees trained against them, and there were bare fruit trees growing in the winter brown grass. Mary looked for it, and yet when she had entered the upper end of the garden, she had noticed the wall did not seem to end with the orchard, but to extend beyond it. She could see the tops of trees above the wall. She stopped and listened to the bird that she saw, and somehow his cheerful, friendly little whistle gave her a pleased feeling. Even a disagreeable little girl may be lonely, and the big closed house and the bare moor and the big green garden had made this one feel as if there was no one left in the world but herself. If she had been an affectionate child who had been used to being loved, it would have broken her heart. But even though she was Mrs. Mary quite contrary, she was desolate, and the bright-breasted little bird brought a look into her sour little face, which was almost a smile. She listened to him, and she liked him and wondered if she would ever see him again. Perhaps he lived in the mysterious garden and knew all about it. Perhaps it was because she had nothing whatever to do that she thought so much of the deserted garden. She was curious about it and wanted to see what it was like. Why had Mr. Archibald Craven buried the key? If he had liked his wife so much, why did he hate the garden? She wondered if she should ever see him. But she knew that if she did, she should not like him, and he would not like her, and that she only would stand and stare at him and say nothing. Though she would be wanting dreadfully to ask him why he had done such a queer thing. People never like me, and I never like people, she thought, and I could never talk as the Crawford children could. They were always talking and laughing and making noises. She thought of the robin, of the way he seemed to sing her song. I believe that tree was in the secret garden. I feel sure it was. The tree the bird was on, I'm sure it's in the secret garden. There was a wall around the place, and there was no door. She walked back into the first kitchen garden she had entered and found the old man digging. I've been into the other garden, she said. There was nothing to prevent thee, he answered caressingly. I went into the orchard. There was no dog at the door to bite thee, he answered. There was no door there into the other garden, said Mary. What garden? He said in a rough voice, stopping his digging for a moment. The one at the other end of the wall, said Mistress Mary. There are trees there. I saw the tops of them. A bird with a red breast was sitting on them, and he sang. To her surprise, the surly old beaten man with a beaten face actually changed his expression. A slow smile spread. It made her think that it was curious how much nicer a person looked when he smiled. She had not thought of it before. He turned to the orchard and whistled, a low, soft whistle. She had not understood how such a surly man would make such a coaxing sound. Almost the next moment, a wonderful thing happened. She heard a soft little rushing flight through the air, and it was the bird with the big red breast flying to them, and he actually lightened on the big clod of earth next to them. Here he is, chuckled the old man. And then he spoke to the bird, as if he were speaking to a child. Where hast thou been, thee cheeky little beggar? He said. I've not seen thee before today. Hast thou begun their courtin' this early in the season? Thou art too forward. Well, we'll finish this chapter. Let's finish this up the next time. Oh no, we only have a few more pages. Let's do this. We only have 4 pages, so we'll go on. What do you think? Yay, Dino says. He seemed quite familiar. Mary had a queer feeling in her throat because the bird was so pretty and cheerful. He had a teeny little plump body and a delicate beak and slender, delicate legs. Will he always come when you call him? She asked. Aye, that he will. I've known him ever since he was a fledgling. He came out of thy nest in the other garden, and first he flew over there a while. He was too weak to fly back for a few days, and we got friendly. When he went over the wall again, the rest of the brood was gone, and he was lonely, and he came back to me. "What kind of bird is he?" Mary asked. "Doesn't thou know? He's a robin redbreast, and they're the friendliest, curious birds alive. They're almost as friendly as the dogs, if you know how to get on with them. Watch him pecking about there and looking round at us now, and again he knows we're talking about him." It was the queerest thing in the world to see the old fellow. He looked at the plump little scarlet waistcoated bird as if he were both proud and fond of him. "He's conceited one," he chuckled. "He likes to hear folk talk about him. And curious, bless me, there never was his like for curiosity and meddling. He's always coming to see what I'm planting. He knows all the things Mr. Craven never troubled himself to find out. He's a head gardener, he is." The robin flapped about, busily pecking in the soil, and then stopped and looked at them a little. Mary thought his black dewdrop eyes gazed at her with great curiosity. "Where did the rest of the brood go?" she asked. "There's no knowing. The old ones turn them out of their nests and make them fly, and they're scattered before you know it. There one was a knowing one, and he knew he was lonely." Mistress Mary went a step nearer to the robin and looked at him very hard. "I'm lonely," she said. She had not known before that this was one of the things which made her feel sour and cross. She seemed to find it out when the robin looked at her. The old gardener pushed his cap back on his bald head and stared at her a minute. "Aren't thou a little wench from India?" he asked. Mary nodded. "Then no wonder thou art lonely. Thou'll be lonelier before thou's done." He began to dig again. "What is your name?" Mary inquired. He stood up to answer her. "Ben Weatherstaff," he answered, and then he added with a surly chuckle, "I'm lonely myself, except when he's with me," and he jerked his thumb toward the robin. "He's the only friend I've got." "I have no friends at all," said Mary. "I've never have. My eye didn't like me, and I've never played with anyone." It is a Yorkshire habit to say what you think with blunt frankness, and old Ben Weatherstaff was a Yorkshire moor. "Man, then and me are very good bit alike," he said. "We are woven out of the same cloth. We're neither of us good looking, and we're both of us as sour as we look. We've got the same nasty tempers, both of us, I'll warrant." This is plain speaking, and Mary Lennox had never heard the truth about herself in her life. Native servants always salaamed and submitted to you, whatever you did. She had never thought much about her looks, but she wondered if she was unattractive as Ben thought. She also wondered if she looked as sour as he had looked before the robin came. She actually began to wonder if she was nasty-tempered. She felt uncomfortable. Suddenly a clear, rippling little sound broke out near her, and she turned around. She was standing a few feet from a young apple tree, and the robin had flown into one of its branches. Ben Weatherstaff laughed outright. "What did he do that for?" asked Mary. "He's made up his mind to make friends with thee. Dang me if he hasn't took a fancy to thee," replied Ben. "To me?" said Mary, and she moved toward the little tree softly and looked up. "Would you make friends with me?" she said to the robin, as if she was speaking to a person. "Would you?" And she did not say it either in her hard little voice or in her impetuous Indian voice, but in a tone so soft and eager and coaxing that Ben Weatherstaff was as surprised as she had been when she heard him whistle. "Why," he cried out, "thou said that as nice as a human as if there were a real child instead of a sharp old woman. Thou said it almost like Dickon talks to his wild things on the moor." "Do you know Dickon?" Mary asked, turning around. "Everybody knows him. Dickon wandering about everywhere. The very blackberries and heather bells knows him. I warrant the foxes shows him where their cubs lie, and now skylarks doesn't hide their nests from him." Mary would have liked to ask some more questions. She was almost as curious about Dickon as she was about the deserted garden. But just at that moment, the robin who had ended his song gave a little shake of his wings, spread them, and flew away. He had made his visit and had other things to do. "He has flown over the wall," Mary cried out, watching him. "He has flown into the orchard. He has flown across the other wall, into the garden where there is no door." He lives there," said Ben. "He comes out of that egg there. If he's courting, he's making up to some young madam of a robin that lives amongst the old trees there. Rose tree, said Mary. Are there rose trees? Ben Weatherstaff looked up at his spade again, took up his spade again and began to dig. There were 10 years ago, he mumbled. I should like to see them. Where is the green door? There must be a door somewhere. Ben drove his spade deep and looked as uncompatible as he had looked when she first saw him. There was 10 years ago, but there isn't now. No door? There must be. None as many one can find, and none as if there's any business. Don't you try to be a meddlesome wench and poke your nose where it's no place to go. Here, I must go on with my work. Get ye gone and play ya. Get ye gone and play ya. I've no more time. And he actually stopped digging, threw his spade over his shoulder and walked off without even glancing at her or saying goodbye. Well, I never, thought Mary. The next time we read The Cry in the Quarter, Chapter 5. All right, guys. Well, goodbye, says Dino. Goodbye, says Turtle. And we'll dance you off. Yes, yes, yes. Goodbye from Silly and Sissy and Dino and Turtle. Yay!